So good morning, everyone. All of you early risers, thank you for coming to our event here. My name is Dr. Kathleen Ferrick Rosenblatt. I'm a licensed acupuncturist and author. And I would like to introduce my associate, Lynn Pence, a campaign manager and events coordinator, live events coordinator. I would also like to introduce Ralph Schoenman. I don't think he needs too much introduction. Ralph is the producer and moderator of a radio show called Taking Aim on WBAI. And I'd also like to introduce Phil Berg. He's the former Deputy Attorney General of Pennsylvania, and he has been the prosecutor, and he's represented two major important cases for 9/11. Actually, there's an ongoing same case for Ellen Mariani. She was one of the widows of 9/11, and now he's doing a RICO case that continues for William Rodriguez, the custodian of the North Tower. And so we're going to be talking this morning about strategy. And one of our strategies, Lynn and I are co-founders of the 9/11truthla.us organization in Los Angeles. And together we have produced a citizens grand jury that had two convenings. Lynn was the convener, and we had the first one in October of 2004 and August of 2005. And this thing is a very historical event, and you know, we didn't know whether it was just theater or whether we could really have some legs, but we absolutely did it, and according to all the procedures that we understood about grand juries. But now this morning, we're not going to just talk about the actual historic event. We're going to talk about the potential, the ongoing, our ongoing research into grand juries, and our discovery that there was a change, an enormous change, of usurping this patrimony of grand juries. Because grand juries were actually the fourth branch of government. Who would have thought that the people had an actual branch that was very distinct? And all grand juries used to be independent grand juries up until 1946, when a slimy little ruling came in there and reinterpreted it. They couldn't change the Constitution, but they just did a ruling at this very vulnerable moment in history, 1946, when people are just recovering from the war. So they slipped this through and virtually changed it overnight so that independent grand juries would now be illegal. So we're going to be covering all of these things. They couldn't actually make it illegal, but they, you know, it was virtually became illegal. Everyone thought that it was. So without further ado, I'd like to start talking about the grand jury, give you sort of the overview. So on those days in 2004, 2005, citizens, concerned citizens and expert witnesses got together and had a town meeting at Patriotic Hall. It was actually called Bob Hope Patriot Hall in downtown Los Angeles. Beautiful building. And we elected and convened a citizens grand jury. And with our conclusions, we decided that the Keene-Hamilton Commission was erroneous and fraudulent and, you know, just ridiculous. And we found probable cause to indict 20 individuals from the highest levels of government and the military and the private sector. And our conclusions demand legal consideration in criminal prosecution and civil liability and political condemnation throughout the world. And we found that the official story was physically impossible, contradictory, implausible, and fraudulent. So the important thing, though, is that even though we did this grand jury, we've now got to get it acknowledged officially. So in our research, we found an article in the Creighton Law Review by an attorney named Roger Roots. And the title of the article was, "If It's Not a Runaway, It's Not a Real Grand Jury." And what Roger Roots did was trace the history of grand juries back to the founding fathers and their intentions that this be a legitimate form of a check on the government. But this was subverted by this little-known 1946 legislative lie of epic proportions. Now, just to give you a little bit of the history, in 1974, Supreme Court Justice Powell stated, and I quote him, "The institution of the grand jury is deeply rooted in Anglo-American history. In England, since the Magna Carta in 1215, the grand jury served as a protector of citizens against arbitrary and oppressive government action. In this country, the founders thought that the grand jury so essential to basic liberties that they stated in the Fifth Amendment that no person can be held for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless instituted by a presentment or indictment of a grand jury." Now, this term presentment, well, you'll see, is very important because this was the independent finding, the official statement or conclusion of a grand jury. Indictment needed the prosecutor. "This fundamental right," I continue the quote, "not to be held," no, this is not his quote, this is our quote, "not to be held or incarcerated unless by presentment or indictment has been completely turned around by the current president's arbitrary label of enemy combatant. This has been rubber stamped by Congress, codified in the Patriot Act, and justified by the War on Terror." An example of what we have today. But to continue with Roger Rootes, "The grand jury is supposed to act as a check on the government, a people's watchdog. And it is clear that the Constitution intended that the grand jury would have the power to instigate criminal charges. And they were understood to have broad powers of oversight on the government. They were allowed to act at direct odds with the prosecutor or the judge. And they were allowed to exclude prosecutors from their presence at any time. Who would have thought? And to investigate public officials without governmental influence. They were supposed to ferret out government corruption. That was the primary purpose. In other words, the founding fathers understood that governments always tend toward corruption if left unchecked. So we have lost this patrimony. We've lost our part of the government. So when this big change came in 1946 with the adoption of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, suddenly independently acting grand juries were deemed obsolete and subsequently presumed illegal in practice. One of these drafters of these rulings, Lester Orfield, wrote, "The term presentment should not be used in the new rules of criminal procedure because this might encourage the use of the runaway grand jury, which could act from their own knowledge or observation, and not only from charges made by the U.S. attorney. It has become the practice for the U.S. attorney to attend grand jury hearings, hence the use of presentments has been abandoned." So this was a blatant denial of the people's constitutional power for oversight. And this derogatory term, runaway grand jury, was the spin to cast aspersions on this power of sovereign citizens to be responsible for those that govern them, or those who govern at their behest. Now, it's interesting, the term citizen, we called our thing the citizen's grand jury. We are now changing it to the people's grand jury because it turns out that statutory law governs citizens and it gives them privileges. But doesn't give them rights. It's the common law that gives the people their natural rights. So it turns out the word people is much more powerful than the word citizen. So that's a very interesting discovery for us. So ironically, on the other hand, it is the ultimate neoconservative, Justice Antonin Scalia, who effectively codified the unique independent power of this fourth branch of government. When he delivered the opinion of the court in 1992, in discussing the power and unique independence granted to a grand jury in the case United States versus Williams, Justice Scalia laid down the law of the land to quote, "Rooted in long centuries of Anglo-American history, the grand jury is mentioned in the Bill of Rights, but not in the body of the Constitution. It has not been textually assigned, therefore, to any of the branches described in the first three articles. It is a constitutional fixture in its own right." But of course, in practice, contemporary grand juries function basically at the whim of the prosecutor. In practice, if one sits on a grand jury today, all the procedure requires the prosecutor to sign everything. The prosecutor runs the show. He can easily throw something out, so the criminal charges of the grand jury never even reach the judge. And a good example of, a disheartening example of this is the the petition that was written by Kyle Hentz and I believe Nick Levis, that was given to the Attorney General Elliot Spitzer, a petition that was signed by anywhere from 10,000 people, 11,000 people, so I believe on websites, internet's been added by many, many thousands. This is presented to the Attorney General, and it's never been given any attention. You know, they just ignore it. So the will of the people is just completely ignored. So, returning to the present day, it is this ancient power of common law that the convener of the grand jury, Lynn Pence, drew upon in the power of the Fifth Amendment and the Seventh Amendment. And in association with our witness experts, Webster Tarpley, Barbara Honegger, Don Paul, Jim Hoffman, Christopher Boleyn, and David Ray Griffin, we had this citizens grand jury on October 23rd, 2004, and August 27th, 2005, where we exercised our powers like the citizens of Vermont that, according to some stories, they seem to still try to do anyways in Vermont. And Barbara opened the proceedings and explained some of the history to us all. So at this point, I think I'm going to pass it over to my associate, Lynn Pence, to talk a little bit about our strategies talk about the event itself and then our strategies of how we can bring in all of you. We want to bring in other cities to do another event, linking up with other cities, and we have a very dynamic attorney who wants to take it to the Supreme Court if necessary. And we're also going to be working with Bill Berg to help promote his suit. And so, Lynn, would you please take on?
Sure.